ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. If you've ever wondered why people behave the way they do, or what it's like to live inside their heads, this is the show for you. We dive deep each week into a topic related to mental health or psychology, from the promise and perils of manifesting, to how to get better sleep, to what it's like to experience psychosis. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. Our summer season continues with a mighty question. Why do nations fail? Later in the show, Cambridge scholar Luke Kemp discusses the collapse of societies from ancient Rome to the present day. What are the warning signs, he asks? What are the lessons? But first, to a new history of the union movement in Australia. Solidarity forever was the great cry, but in this country, solidarity had its limits. Indigenous stockmen and Torres Strait Islanders were left to look after themselves. Chinese cabinet makers in Victoria were not seen as fellow workers, but the enemy. Greek and Italian workers who arrived here after the war were also left to fend for themselves. So, for a long time, were women. The workers left behind are a particular focus of a new history of the trade union movement, No Power Greater, by biographer and academic Liam Byrne. Liam, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much, David. It's lovely to be here.
Liam, in the beginning, trade unions were for white men, no?
Well, the union movement was originated in a particular context. And this is one of the things that I try to do in the book, is that the first priority for me as an historian is to try to understand the historical actors that we're talking about, to understand their worldview, where it came from, and to, you know, to really comprehend the social factors that led to the origination of the movement. And I think it's really important to point out that the union movement in Australia originated in an imperial context, in the context of the British Empire's colonisation of the continent of Australia. And so we're talking about a colonial populace, people within that colonial context, who were predominantly skilled white men who were organising to protect their position within a labour market that was unequal, where they felt like their fundamental humanity was being consistently denied to them by employers who were treating them like machines. And so they had this desire to assert their humanity and to have their humanity recognised. But as you note, there were limits to their conceptualisation of what their humanity was and who should have access to that, which was conditioned by that colonial context and the ideology of the British Empire. And that meant that the union movement, the early unions, did perpetuate exclusions.
Tell us about the Chinese Cabinet Makers Union of Victoria.
Well, Chinese Cabinet Makers Union is an extraordinary organisation. It originated in the 1880s in Melbourne, particularly in Melbourne, within the furniture trade. And it's really important to point out that at this time, as mentioned, the British Empire was based on a racialised hierarchy that placed white Britishers at the top. So as we know, the British Empire was based on the dispossession of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, and it was also based upon forms of exclusion, racial exclusion. And so this is part of the backgrounds of what was taking place in terms of the industry and the trade itself. And then within that broader dynamic, you do have European-dominated trade unions, which viewed Chinese workers as a threat to their labour standards, a threat to our fundamental rights that they had won. And this was conditioned by sort of racist caricatures of particularly Chinese workers, which conceptualised them as being predominantly cheap labour. It's a term that was used at the time. There's other terms that were used at the time that I won't repeat because of the horrendous nature of the racism. And these were common parlance across wide swathes of the union movement. And a lot of attention and emphasis was put into the European-dominated movement to try to find ways to exclude Chinese workers from various parts of the industry. Now, within the industry, Chinese workers, they organised. because they themselves, they also had the difficulty that they experienced of not having an equal relationship on the labour market. They were denied, you know, their fundamental humanity, but then that was further conditioned by the racism that they experienced in broader society and from European unions. So they organised to assert their own rights, to make their own claims. One of the dynamics of the exclusion that they experienced was quite often Chinese workers were only able to work for Chinese employers. And so they, what they did was that they organised their own union to represent their interest within that context. And it had some amazing campaign strikes in the 1880s and 1890s, campaigning for things such as a reduction of their work week to 50 hours. In particular, they had a campaign to increase the piece rates. So this is piece rates is when you're paid by the item that you produce rather than the amount of time that you've worked. So they campaigned for increases in that and really asserted their own rights through their own agency, their own collective action, their own organisation.
Another tactic that the wider union movement might have used is to demand that employers pay Chinese cabinet makers exactly what white cabinet makers were paid. That would have solved the problem too, would it not?
Well, exactly. It's really, in terms of the breakdown of solidarity in this period, is that a unifying campaign, a unifying claims would have strengthened the workers' movement as a whole. Now, there was a movement at this time, it's worth pointing out, which was to shift towards a minimum wage. So basically before 1895, when a significant debate took place, that there wasn't a minimum wage that existed in Australian industries, or in fact, a compulsory legal minimum wage didn't exist anywhere in the world. So there was a shift and a move to create a minimum wage here in Victoria that was successful as part of amendments to the Factory Acts that were introduced in 1895, came into operation in 1896, through the form of what were called wages boards, which would mean that there would be employer and employee representatives who would effectively bargain over what wages should be in certain industries, and that would set a basic rate. Now, it was the case that for the Chinese Cabinet Makers Union, that while there were some members who, you know, absolutely supported that, there were also other members who highlighted that for many of their members, that they were actually being disadvantaged by the enforcement of that system, and particularly made reference to elderly workers and workers who, in their language at the time, were infirm. It was very, very difficult for those workers in a Chinese Cabinet Makers Union to actually have their interests represented because the broader movement, which was trying to create this minimum wage to cover all workers, again, it excluded them. They weren't an active part of those deliberations because the broader union movement did not conceptualize the Chinese Cabinet Makers Union as one of their own.
And seeing that name again, Chinese Cabinet Makers Union, reminds me that the Federation Fathers nearly put into the Australian Constitution a prohibition of racist legislation and decided not to because it might empower the Chinese Cabinet Makers Union. What Australia might have had.
Well, it's also interesting that, as I mentioned before, the wages boards that were in operation in four different industries set a minimum wage, and employers and employees were effectively elected to undertake that sort of work. Edna Ryan, who's a fantastic feminist and labour historian, she's gone through those records and found that it was actually in the industry that covered cabinet makers. It's the one where the representatives were appointed rather than elected, which again was a direct means to try to prevent Chinese employers and employees from having representation on those wage boards. So those acts of exclusion are very, very consistent, obviously driven by the racism of this time. And you really, really, you know, across the entirety of the working experience, Chinese workers experienced this exclusion, racism, it shaped their interaction with the labour market, but also just the interaction more broadly with society. It's a really, really dark mark on our national history and something we need to talk about more.
So, Liam, what were the tactics of the Chinese Cabinet Makers Union? How successful were they?
Well, it's really important to point out that the Chinese Cabinet Makers Union, they were a union. They weren't recognised by the European movement, or the white movement, as being a legitimate union, but they were. They were a collective organisation of working people seeking to assert their fundamental demands. And so they undertook the exact same tactics that other unions took. So they would undertake industrial action when necessary. They would agitate. They would, you know, make sure that they were having advocacy directly to employers, and they would bargain. There's a really famous case of this which took place in 1903 in Melbourne at the end of 1903, where effectively what happened was that the Chinese Furniture Employers Union was founded by employers in the industry. And the Chinese Cabinet Makers Union was actually concerned at the fact that the employers had created this organisation because it was predominantly representing larger employers. And the Chinese Cabinet Makers Union was concerned that this was basically a means to squeeze out smaller employers and limit opportunities the Chinese Cabinet Makers would have to gain employment. Because again, as I mentioned before, the racist exclusions at a time meant that it was very, very difficult for Chinese workers to find employment outside of enterprises that were owned by Chinese employers.
Yeah.
And so it limited their options. And so the Chinese Cabinet Makers Union, in addition to a long-running sort of series of complaints about low wages and the way they're being treated at work, when this happened, they were very, very deeply concerned and they undertook action to try to change that. And so the strike that took place at the end of 1903, it was an incredible sort of collective action that took place over a course of months. It was something which the overwhelming majority of Chinese workers in the trade were involved in. It was very, very bitter. At one point, employers actually tried to bring strike breakers from Sydney to do the work of the unionists, which again, the broader union movement would have recognised that tactic as well. But the Chinese Cabinet Makers Union continued to, you know, stand by each other and demonstrate that solidarity internally, solidarity with one another. They had a massive collection of funding that they'd actually brought in from, you know, people paying to the union fund to make sure that they could sustain themselves. And over the course of many months, they also articulated what it was that they were trying to achieve with that strike, that they wanted a pay increase. They didn't want to be treated, they didn't want to be paid less than what their value, the actual value of their work. They didn't want excessive work hours. And so it's really, really interesting that all the caricatures, all the racist stereotypes that the broader movement was labeling at Chinese workers, they were directly countering that with their action. And they were aware that that was the way they were viewed. And they were trying to bust those stereotypes in the context of the strike as well, which is, you know, it's a remarkable event. And by the end of it, after 2 months, the Chinese Cabinet Makers Union actually won. They won the strike. They won their demanded increases. And they maintained their place in the trade, which is a remarkable accomplishment.
I'm talking to Liam Byrne, who is the author of A New History of the Trade Union Movement in Australia called No Power Greater. Liam, nearly half a century later, Indigenous workers in the bush were also organising their own union. What's the history of that? How successful was it? Why wasn't it part, an integrated part of the trade union movement itself?
Well, the struggle of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander workers against dispossession and ongoing effects of colonisation is an extraordinary part of our history and something that should be better known and better taught. There's many different collective actions that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander workers took, particularly in the early part of the 20th century, and a really, really strong contribution that was made by active union members, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander union members, to that collective organisation and action. What you have in a situation, particularly the one, perhaps the most famous of the strikes that took place, was in the Pilbara, which began in 1946. Now, one of the things that Aboriginal workers in the pastoral industry experienced was, over a long period of time, hyper-exploitation. Even though a lot of their contribution to that industry has been written out of history, the reality is that industry could not have existed without the skilled work that those Aboriginal workers did and their hyper-exploitation that white employers imposed upon them. When I talk about hyper-exploitation, what I'm talking about is the fundamental denial of wages and then the denial of equal wages, absolutely, and a whole range of different measures which were imposed on Aboriginal workers in the industry to deny them even the most basic control over their own lives by state authorities and by their employers. So, for instance, Aboriginal workers on pastoral stations couldn't leave those stations without the written permission of their employer, which is a common way to try to control movement, curtail their Aboriginal workers' ability to control their own lives. So in 1946, a strike broke out in the Pilbara, and it was an extraordinary moment. It was one that was many, many months in the planning, and it was a coordinated action that took place that was engineered by a number of Aboriginal leaders, Clancy McKenna and Dooley Binbin, our most prominent among them. Daisy Bindi was also a very significant leader, with the support of Don McLeod, who was a non-Indigenous activist who supported their strike. The strike began on the 1st of May with around 800 workers going out on strike from 12 different pastoral stations. And they went out on strike on the 1st of May. They walked out from their stations and refused to do work for two reasons. One, because the 1st of May was the beginning of the shearing season. And the other one is it coincided with May Day, the International Day of Worker Protest. The significant thing that happened with that strike was Aboriginal workers in the pastoral industry were excluded because of various racist measures from the industrial system and the protections that existed within the industrial system, and that's part of how the hyper-exploitation was enabled and was undertaken. So what you do have is that there's this exclusion from the basic industrial system. But those Aboriginal workers demanded that fundamental recognition, equal wages, and greater control over their own lives, which is a very, very fundamental demand. The strike went from 1946 to 1949, What happened in 1949 was that two of the pastoral stations actually conceded the demands to the Aboriginal workers, that the strike had been effective in getting two stations to say that they would pay the increase in wages and give greater control that Aboriginal workers were looking for. The Aboriginal workers then appealed to the Seamen's Union of Australia to not transport wool from the other stations that hadn't yet conceded. And what happened in that, the Seamen's Union of Australia, they had a mass meeting of their members who voted to say that they would show support and solidarity with the Aboriginal workers, that they identified the struggle and that the struggle was one that they believed was connected to their own, and that they would not transport the wool that was taken from stations that hadn't conceded the strikers' demand. What happened next was actually quite a shameful episode where a government representative who was liaising with the Aboriginal strikers said that after the shearing season that they would look into sort of orchestrating a general increase of wages. They later reneged on that promise, and so the strikers had to continue to negotiate with employers on a one-on-one basis. But what you did have there was an incredible collective action by Aboriginal workers themselves that fundamentally, again, challenged the stereotypes and challenged the exclusion and insisted that Aboriginal workers should have a right to negotiate for their wages and conditions, just like other workers, with the support of the Seamen's Union.
But the problems were not solved until Wave Absolutely. Hill some years later.
Well, I do have to say, David, that I think in the ongoing struggle against dispossession, that is a continuing struggle. The reality is that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples continue to experience the ongoing effects of dispossession, including inequalities in the labour market. And the union movement is very much led by its Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Committee, which is a self-determining committee which leads and directs our work in that area and has made a significant contribution, which the book talks about as well.
In those same years, post-war years, while Indigenous workers were going on strike to fight for their rights, the Australian workforce received thousands of workers from Greece, Italy, and your book questions how well they were actually dealt with by the union movement itself, which seemed, apart from anything else, to insist that everything be done in English.
Yeah, so the post-war migration was a really incredible moment of Australian history, very transformative. And I think it'd be fair to say that the attitude across the union movement towards the post-war migration, which is predominantly, as you say, from Italy, Greece and other areas that were dubbed at the time as Southern Europe, it was mixed. There was a mixed reception to it. There was Albert Monk, who was president of the ACTU, was actually a very, very prominent supporter of the post-war migration program and from the union movement, and wanted to make sure that that it was done in a manner which would ensure that economic growth and full employment would mean that all workers were gaining the benefits from these programs. But there was other unionists who did conceive this as being a threat and were concerned about that. So that's the broader dynamic, background to what was going on within the union movement. And then you do have this situation where large numbers of workers who are coming to Australia, as you say, from Greece and Italy in particular, many, many deeply skilled workers with a huge amount to contribute are coming to Australia as part of this program, large numbers of whom are finding places at work within the manufacturing industry and other industries at the time, often what today you would kind of refer to as like blue-collar work in either manufacturing or other assemblage types of roles. And quite often it was a time that people did not have high levels of English proficiency necessarily. Their employers would make absolutely no effort to explain or speak to them in their own language.
Not even put safety instructions into Greek and Italian.
That's right. Yeah. Safety instructions would be read in English. And as you mentioned, so that was the sort of experience you would receive from employers. And there was a real hesitation from many unions, not all unions, it should be said, but from many unions to translate and to speak in other languages, because there was a belief by some unionists that migrants should be learning English in their own time and that was kind of their responsibility, not the union's responsibility. And migrant workers who were involved in their unions, a very powerful and very important part of a union, they challenged that, and they challenged that form of that attitude and tried to push for a far more inclusive union movement that would recognise their needs, legitimate needs as workers.
Liam, given that the union movement is now run by a woman, headed by a woman, given that more women than men are now unionists, it seems, on reflection, extraordinary that the union movement was for so long not entirely rejecting the role of women, but not seeing the women's struggle for better conditions as sort of central to its mission.
Well, I think it's important, again, to return to the context of the origination of the movement and to understand what the gendered conceptualization of work was in British imperial society. Because in the 19th century, it was believed widely that the predominant role that women were supposed to be playing, particularly women of the colonial population, were as wives as mothers, not as workers. And that was not an attitude exclusive to the union movement. In fact, that was an attitude very much driven by people in far more powerful positions. It was a dominant ideology of the time. And so what you have in that period was that women who were involved in the workforce, and they were involved in the workforce, it's a mythology that women weren't, but they were predominantly doing jobs in positions within the labour market where it was kind of considered that they could be tolerated in certain positions, but that ultimately they were only really there to work before they got married or if they happened to be lacking the support of a male breadwinner because they'd been widowed. Because at the time, of course, there was no social safety net. And again, the understanding and the dominant ideology of colonial society was that men would be breadwinners and that women would predominantly operate in the private realm. And it's really important to point out that women unionists, women workers, challenged this exclusion through their own action. One of the most incredible stories in my book, and what I actually begin the book with, is the story of Ellen Creswell, who was a tailoress.
Yes.
And the tailoresses, they were workers in Melbourne, obviously the tailoresses elsewhere as well, but in 1882, who experiencing a cut to their piece rates, so the rates that they were being paid by their employer, they got together, they organised, then they formed their own union. And that union was accepted by the broader movement. And so what you do see is that there is an understanding that women workers in certain industries will, have a right to represent themselves. But there is a broader sort of sense in across wide swathes of the union movement that question the legitimacy of women's work in other sectors and often identify women workers in other sectors as a potential threat to the male standards of pay and conditions that have been established. So I agree with you there. There's that the reflection and perpetuation of those colonial ideologies that you see proceeding through time and that women workers and women unionists consistently had to challenge that within broader society, but also within the union movement. And they did that through a number of campaigns and a lot of advocacy. But one of the dominant issues, which I talk about in the book, is the campaign for equal pay, because that's a fundamental idea that all workers, no matter your gender, should be receiving the same pay rates. And the wage fixation system that had been inherited from the colonial era did not reflect that.
Yeah, but we're not doing too well on that front still, are we?
Which is an incredible sort of demonstration of how the gendered undervaluation of work persists today. Absolutely. And it remains a major issue that the union movement is taking up and campaigns around. And it demonstrates, I think, the systemic nature of that sexism.
Was there also, from the early days of the union movement, a sense that people who were doing piece work, people who were working from home, were not really part of the union movement? They were somehow, off to one side.
There has been deep concern about people working at home and the conditions that they endure. That type of work is referred to as outwork. And this was something that broadly in the 19th century, it was a major concern to the union movement and to other sort of organisations. A lot of community advocacy organisations were concerned about this as well. So Ellen Creswell, who I mentioned to begin with, the tailoresses, she had conducted outwork. And one of the concerns that she had and that other unionists had was that employers were using outworkers who were contracted by what were referred to as middlemen, so they weren't directly employed by these large employers, but these large employers were seeking this work to be done by these outworkers as a means to not have to directly employ workers and pay them their appropriate wages and conditions. So there's long been a concern in the union movement that employers have cynically used outwork as a means to try to undermine wages and conditions. Now, of course, the union movement has always had a wide array of perspectives. It's a movement of millions now of many different perspectives. And so there is a range between people who said, well, we need to organise and make sure that outworkers are actively involved in the movement and others who wanted to more actively exclude them. That attitude has absolutely existed as well. And in more current sort of terms and more recent eras, there's outwork again has remains a phenomenon today. It is still a regular work relation that people have. And the union movement has demonstrated very much a lot of attention to engaging with and doing outreach work with outworkers to ensure that they're aware of the rights that the union has won.
And how's the union going, turning to another long-running battle, how's the union going protecting gay teachers?
One of the things in my book that I really, really found quite meaningful to talk about is the early sort of history of gay and lesbian in the parlance of the time worker organising. For myself, as being a member of the LGBTIQA+ community, it was really incredibly moving to hear the stories of workers who were seeking a way just to be themselves at work and to feel that their humanity was being fully recognised and the way that they agitated for a place for this within the union movement. So it's particularly in the 1970s, the early 1970s, was a phenomenon of a number of sort of relatively informal sort of groupings of gay and lesbian workers in an array of different industries who were increasingly coming together. And they weren't in formal union organisations, but these workers were almost always union members. And so it was very, very natural for them to seek to make advocacy for, you know, towards the union movement and to find their place within it and to make challenging homophobia and discrimination a union issue. The gay teachers group here in Melbourne, it took to the 1976 conference of the Victorian Secondary Teachers Union, a proposal to create what was known then as a subcommittee of homosexuality, which was created and which subsequently led to the union accepting policy explicitly against discrimination and stating clearly that, you know, in parlance at the time, homosexual teachers had a place in the union, a place in a profession, and that they shouldn't be experiencing discrimination, which in the 1970s was a very, very progressive stance to take.
Do you think the union movement is still governed by the expectations of its time now, and that we might look back in 20, 30 years' time and be bewildered by what is not being protected, what is not being advocated by the union movement?
It's a great question, David. And as an historian, it's always really powerful to reflect back on the, you know, the course and the sort of like the broad sweep of union history, which is what I'm doing, you know, covering the better part of two centuries. And to see both, you know, the extraordinary changes and the things that have been challenged and have been overcome, but also the consistencies in union activism and the consistencies in what working people have been trying to do. And I think one of the biggest things over the two centuries is that in different ways, working people have been insisting that we have a right to be humans and to be treated as humans, and that that is a right that needs to be expressed in our industrial conditions, in our laws, and in the way society treats workers. And we also have workers who've experienced exclusions advocating for their right to be human, not just as workers, but as members of those communities. And it's a really powerful part of the union story is the way workers from excluded communities have undertaken action and have changed the way the union movement thinks and understands things. So I think in any movement for progressive change, no matter what it is, if you're in the business of changing the world and making things better, you should be constantly reflecting on what that means and changing your understanding of it. And the great thing about the union movement and the exciting thing about this history is how often those changes have been driven by those members of the excluded communities themselves, their agency, their drive for change, and they've played a massive role in transforming the way the union movement understands itself and the world that it's in. So I think that's a constant process of change, and I hope that it remains that way, because the idea of, you know, we have a fundamental humanity that needs to be protected, I think, unfortunately, is just as relevant as ever in a day of new technologies, in a day of, you know, growing inequality across Australia, much of Australia and the world. The union movement is still relevant. It's still necessary. And I hope that, you know, that it continues to articulate that humanizing mission.
Liam, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Fantastic. It was such a pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity.
I've been talking to Dr. Liam Byrne about his new history of the union movement in Australia. The book is called No Power Greater, and it's published by Melbourne University Press. Coming up, how societies collapse.
David Marr on ABC Radio National.
Sometimes we miss the point of the most familiar, famous sayings in the English language. E.g., Benjamin Franklin on death and taxes. Our new constitution is now established and has an appearance that promises permanency, he wrote. But in this world, nothing can be said to be certain, except death and taxes. Franklin wasn't moaning about death and taxes. He was delivering a great warning that states fail. The United States may look permanent, but there is no guarantee that it would survive. And states don't, is the conclusion of my guest today, Luke Kemp, who's recently published a vast survey of the collapse of states called Goliath's Curse, The History and Future of Societal Collapse. Luke, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Why is this subject so profoundly fascinating? Why do we, as we study history, as we think about the past, always come back to the question of why this empire, this state, has failed?
I think there's three good reasons. One is that people have always been profoundly interested and fascinated by the end of worlds, whether it be the apocalypse, eschatology, as we call it, or just simply catastrophe and crisis. I think the second is that we are, in many ways, the victors of history, and collapse is something which essentially haunts even the most powerful of empires. And so it's natural that we tend to kind of look over our shoulders at the wreckages of the past and wonder if we're going to end up the same. And I think last but not least is that collapse in many ways is a term propaganda. When you look at the different ways collapse has been written about, it's generally by a small number of scribes employed by kings and elites who talk about collapse as a way of warning, if there's no hierarchy, if there's no kings, things will fall apart and will be absolutely terrible and awful. And when you actually look at the archaeological record, that's not always the case. So I think we've also been handed down a set of stories which have emphasized collapse and probably overemphasized how bad it is. And as a very brief aside, the funny thing with the death and taxes idea is that taxes are probably only around about 5,000 years old.
And taxes matter, as we'll get to in the argument as we go through. You write, and it's a beautiful line, once you pull on the thread of collapse, the entire tapestry of history begins to unravel. What do you mean by that?
I want to do quite a restricted study, just looking at collapse to better understand the risks we face in the future. And I found quite quickly that was essentially impossible without addressing far bigger questions, such as, why were states even created in the first place? Were they good for the citizens and the subjects who lived within them? And how do people actually act during crises and catastrophes? And what I found was that in almost all of those cases, my intuitions and the ideas have been handed down ever since high school were profoundly challenged. For instance, most of us tend to think of civilization as being essentially both an intentional and benevolent act, that people came together in large groups because they started to have grain, for instance. And as you had bigger groups of people, you needed to basically coordinate them to do bigger projects. And so hence we had kings, etc. And that just simply isn't really the case. When you look at what really unites all civilizations throughout history, it tends to be things like slavery, patriarchy, domination, basically. And the only real set of common factors across why civilizations arise across the world is actually things like having resources which are easily taken, stored, and transported. And so that's why, for instance, you have many states which are built on rice and wheat, which can be stored for up to decades or more. But you don't have any which are built on, say, for instance, taro or bananas. And the other kind of common fact which comes up here is having caged land. So, for instance, Egypt is, of course, buttressed between the Red Sea and the Nile. And on top of that, having weapons that can be easily monopolized by a small group. So you don't see the rise of the first states in either Mesopotamia, so the Near East, or in Egypt, until you start to get bronze handheld swords and axes. So the picture emerging there is that states, when they were first created, were probably acts of subordination, essentially, and domination, that you had a small group essentially taking resources that others were dependent upon, and then more or less using that to create these kind of larger power structures. The power structures we often call civilization. I much prefer Goliath, which really captures what we're actually talking about here, which is these big institutions built on power and violence. But yes, I think that's just one small example of, if you want to really understand collapse, you want to understand why we create these big power structures in the first place. And suddenly you have to address all the big questions in human history.
There was a trade-off though, wasn't there? Hierarchical states brought order, even tough states, an end to chaos.
Yes and no. One of the things I wanted to do with this book was not just to look at the collapse of empires in the last few thousand years, but rather to go back as far as possible to the very beginning of our species. One of the key questions that always pops up there is, when you look 300,000 years ago, when our species first started to evolve in Africa, were we particularly violent? What were the kind of social conditions we evolved in? The best evidence we have right now suggests that we were nomadic egalitarian hunter-gatherers and that we weren't particularly violent. When you look at the archaeological remains, and the largest study here has been done by two archaeologists, Haas and Bishteli, you actually find very, very few skeletal remains which have any signs of violence. Genetic evidence suggests that at the very maximum, we probably had a roughly 2% per year violence rate, which basically means out of 100 deaths per year, two of them would be based upon violent causes, which is around about the same as the global average today if you count suicide. So we're not a particularly violent species. And when you actually look at collapse and the kind of violence that often happens, and of course, collapse does often see these big spikes in bloodshed, it's usually not the entire society killing each other. It's not brother on brother, sister on sister. It's instead usually a very small group of people, generally speaking, young men who are trying to create a new power structure. You know, think of Afghanistan, think of Somalia. It's only a very small group, once again, young men who are usually trying to basically recreate a state or some kind of other power structure. So even in those cases, it's a lot more complicated than this kind of Hobbesian image of a war of all against all. It's nothing like that, actually. It's actually much more state formation. So in many ways, the kind of violence of state collapse is the violence of trying to build a new state.
You make a distinction between collapse and societal collapse. Explain.
So when a state like in Somalia in 1989 falls apart, we call it a state collapse or a state failure. When the economy suddenly breaks apart and economic growth contracts massively, we call it a recession or a depression, or sometimes an economic collapse. When the population dies off very quickly due to a disease or a natural disaster, we call it a demographic collapse or a bust. But when you have multiple systems and of power all go down, so not just the state, but also the economy and potentially the population, when all these happen at once, you can think of it as a societal collapse.
And what, for you, is the key example of a societal collapse where everything goes bust?
Oh, that's a very good question. First of all, it's actually surprisingly rare for all these systems to go down at once and for all of them to go down rapidly. I think we tend to overuse the term collapse when thinking about history. I would say the best example here is actually one of the least well-known, which is Cahokia. So Cahokia was the original city of North America. Around about 1,000 years ago, hunter-gatherers in the Mississippi Basin, about 500 kilometers south of Chicago on the outskirts of modern-day St. Louis, started to create a city. They basically piled up huge mounds of dirt and soil into these vast earthen pyramids with flat tops. It actually looked very similar to what you see in Mayan city-states, for instance, or across Mesoamerica. They started sacrificing people. They started to have elites and kings. And then essentially, within around about 150 years, it starts to fall apart. People more or less seem to vote with their feet and start to leave en masse. This coincides with droughts and several other things, but Cahokia is interesting for a few reasons. Is first of all, it's complete abandonment. The entire city's lost. There's no more hierarchy. Even much of the culture changes as well. So all the kind of key power structures you would associate with a state fall apart. But importantly, it's also really enduring. You know, if this only happens for a year or two, if this is a kind of temporary loss, we wouldn't really consider it a collapse. But when it's enduring, we do. And the case of Cahokia, once the city falls apart, it's never rebuilt. When the Europeans arrived, there are no large-scale cities anymore in Northern America. And even more interesting is that the people there seem to intentionally forget about this experiment with urbanism and priests. There's no oral traditions, no stories in the Mississippi Basin about Cahokia, which is incredibly interesting and surprising, given that this is literally a city of 10,000, 15,000 people. And yet it's almost like they wanted to forget about it and leave it to rot in the swamps of the Mississippi.
I'm talking to Luke Kemp, research affiliate at the Centre for Study of Existential Risk at the University of Cambridge. Luke has also been at times an advisor to the World Health Organization, the Australian Parliament, the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, but we're talking today about his new book, Goliath's Curse, The History and Future of Societal Collapse. Luke, in our culture, the great collapse was the fall of Rome. And I have to ask, did Gibbon get it right?
To put it short, I mean, for those of you at home, Gibbon's key idea...
Did I hear you say no?
Yes, that's a very strong no. I think Gibbon's right that I would consider the collapse, the Western Roman Empire, to have collapsed. But even there, it's worthwhile pointing out that some things change much more rapidly than others. You know, the actual political center of Rome collapses very, very quickly. But the population, well, it doesn't really depopulate for another somewhere between 60 to 100 years. And the kind of ideological basis of Rome, which by that stage was the church, actually continues to grow in power. You know, the church becomes the connective tissue across all of Europe after Rome falls. So it's not like every power structure in society falls apart. Some of them do continue. And likewise, many of the cultures, customs, and even garbs that the Romans had were carried on by Germanic rulers. But nonetheless, the military fragments, the economy plummets, trade breaks up into local levels, and essentially both the elites and the kind of the actual empire itself falls apart. So we're still on good grounds to call it a collapse. The other key thing of Rome is that Gibbons does two things. First of all, he blames it on Christianity, and that's just not true. The key culprit behind the collapse of Rome is inequality.
Yes.
It's much more about inequality and the wealthy than it is about the church and Christianity. And the second one is that Gibbons sees this as being just a fairly horrible event, almost a kind of ancient apocalypse of sorts. And it really wasn't. Rome was, in many ways, an autocratic machine for turning grain into swords and conquest. It was a very large-scale pyramid scheme. And its collapse was, in many ways, a good thing for a lot of people. So when we look at skeletons in Latin Europe after the fall of Rome, people seem to get taller and healthier. So skeletons get larger, and there's less both dental caries and bone lesions. And in general, actually, if you were living outside the empire, you tended to be in a healthier state than if you were living inside the empire.
It's worth remembering that. That's wonderful. That's such a wonderful finding.
Weirdly enough.
But you mentioned inequality, and through your book, I yes. just kept finding this as a theme, that states that become unequal fall. And look around the world today, and inequality is on the march, even in our societies. You know, Australia that you grew up in, Britain where you now work, the United States. Do you see in that growth of inequality the death of states?
Yes. Inequality is the master variable behind crisis and collapse. When we think about a risk, we usually try to break it down to four key components. So one is the threat. This could be, in the case of Rome, invaders. It could be climatic change, which occurred roughly in the 6th century. And it can also be disease. So obviously, I have things like the Justinian Plague in the 6th century as well. But then you also have what's often not paid attention to, the second element of risk, which is vulnerability. And the key thing here is that inequality tends to make states and societies much more vulnerable over time. And in stories of collapse, we tend to get a bit too preoccupied with looking at threats, with things like climate change, with the invaders, these kind of big external shocks. But for many different cases of collapse, you find that different societies handle these pretty well, actually. And then suddenly they seem to become weaker over time. And myself and several colleagues actually did a kind of large-scale data analysis looking at a big database we put together of essentially the lifespan of almost every state across history. And we found that they do appear to become weaker over time. And the most natural explanation here, and the one with the most evidence, is that this is largely due to the fact that inequality seems to increase over time and hence make states more fragile. And I can get into the reasons as to why, if you like.
Well, I wonder whether you'd, what you think about this. After the Second World War, there was a strong emphasis on equality in Britain, Australia, the United States. In Britain, punitive taxes on the very rich, plus wonderful new services to the poor, and a sense that, you know, we've all been through this turmoil together of the Second World War, and the reward would be equality. And perhaps one way of looking at the history of the 80 years since is the political eating away at the equality that was established in that fight.
We often speak about World War One and World War Two as being a time of the Great Compression. Several things happened during the World War. One was that you had enormous destructions in capital, and that essentially meant that the rich just lost much more than the poor did. The second is that, as you mentioned, there was the introduction of a whole bunch of different policies which tended to level the playing field. And these were often necessary to essentially keep the populace happy in a time of war, and more importantly, keep them willing to actually fight on behalf of their country.
Yes.
Today, I suspect that many people would be less willing to fight for the UK or Australia because it's hard to want to fight for something when you can't even afford a house and when you're not even sure if you're going to be taken care of when you're sick, for instance. And last but not least, was just people were armed. And when you have a very large populace which is armed and trained, then suddenly there's a much better reason for the elites to negotiate with them. And as you mentioned, this did result in some pretty huge changes. The highest income bracket in the US during the kind of 1950s was actually above 90%. And it's worth noting that that didn't...
Taxation.
Exactly, yeah. And yeah. It's worth... Yeah. That didn't result in a kind of economic collapse. You know, it's to the contrary, when people talk about making America great again, they're usually thinking about this kind of time, although it obviously wasn't particularly great to be either black or a woman. Nonetheless, I think you're precisely right. Essentially, while there was a great compression of wealth inequality during the 1950s after world wars, you start to see creeping up during the 1980s and 1970s. And shortly after that, we start to see, of course, democratic backsliding and all the issues we're kind of contending with today start to come to the fore. And I think the retreat of democracies around the world is directly related to that increase in wealth inequality. It's not hard to look at the US and think, well, billionaires are basically just more or less buying elections at this stage, and that's a direct outcome of wealth inequality.
It's what made me think of Benjamin Franklin. Mm. Luke, you have this wonderful thing in the book where you've done all your research, you've totted up all the numbers, and you have decided all states throughout history have eventually ended, average lifespan, 326 years. Now, it's outrageous, by the way, but wonderful. What makes a state last longer? What makes a state last shorter? I mean, you know, there are... The Byzantium lasted 1,000 years, but some of the dynasties in China were gone in 4. Can you look... I mean, inequality is there underneath all of this, but... Do big states last longer than small states, for instance?
First of all, I'm glad you mentioned both the average 326, but also more importantly, the range here. People tend to get distracted by the average, but as you mentioned, the Byzantine Empire lasts over 1,000, while the Qin Dynasty lasts for just 14. So there's a huge range here. What makes a society more resilient? What makes it last longer? Part of this is always going to, of course, be luck, but I think that's not the key element. Instead, when you look across numerous case studies, it seems that one of the most important factors here is essentially how democratic and inclusive the institutions are. Peter Peregrin at Yale University has done some of the best studies here looking at how different societies respond with climatic change throughout the past. So he's looked at different instances like the late antique Little Ice Age and tried to tally up what's the amount of cooling different societies faced and the amount of social change they faced as well. So were there assassinations? Was there large-scale loss of population, etc.? And the interesting thing he found was that, first of all, while there's a rough correlation, there were many cases where you had lots of cooling but very little social change. And second, the biggest factor that made a society resilient to climatic change was how inclusive and democratic their institutions were. And this is echoed in modern-day studies as disaster risk resilience, where big meta-reviews have essentially found that having a stronger state with more resources, which is not surprising, but more importantly, having more democratic, inclusive institutions tends to result in states lasting longer, which makes a lot of sense and is kind of, in many ways, the flip side of wealth inequality. Democracy and wealth inequality, of course, aren't quite the same thing, but they do overlap. You know, if you have lots of wealth inequality, it's going to be very hard to keep a democracy in the long term. And when you, for instance, you look at Athenian democracy, that was built on the back of having a pretty high degree of wealth equality. So democracy and inclusive institutions seems to be the big thing that encourages states and societies to often last longer.
Because citizens have an investment in the state in which they live.
That's part of it.
I don't mean cash. I mean, there are reasons to be loyal.
Precisely. It seems to create a greater sense of solidarity and collective identity, what many researchers call social capital, essentially. People feel invested in the community and the state. On top of that, it seems like when you have larger, more diverse groups of people making decisions, you tend to get better decisions. So much of my background is in what's called forecasting foresight. And the best proven methods and used by the intelligence agencies, for instance, are what they use are called super forecasters. So basically groups of people who share information and try to take on a big diverse set of different sources to make predictions about the future. And similarly, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's also just a very, very large group of different people deliberating and sharing information. By comparison, an autocracy is usually a small group of homogenous people who are over-invested in the status quo, trying to make decisions, which is just an ingredient for disaster. And when we look at, say, for instance, climate change today, or even trying to change things like taxation, for instance, it's usually the existing elite class who essentially stop any kind of change from occurring. What is usually benevolent, necessary change. So that's also a key thing, is just simply that when you have huge concentrations of decision-making power, it tends to be with people who don't want to change society and are buffered from oncoming disaster.
You seem to be arguing that the people can take the tough decisions to fix societies and indeed to fight inequality. I don't see much sign of that in Australia, Britain or America at the moment, that the people are capable, for instance, of taxing the rich.
I think absolutely they are. I mean, all societies are, of course, based upon the people. You know, we tend to give far too much credence to people like Elon Musk, for instance, when there's not really that much sign that he's actually a particularly great inventor or even that good a manager. By comparison, most of the enterprises he's created, whether it's SpaceX or Twitter or Tesla, they're built upon the backs of thousands of miners in Africa, programmers in San Francisco, and manufacturers in China. You know, the world is built on the backs of the people. And all the evidence we have suggests that if you want to do good decision-making, you don't rely upon a small number of rich people and just hope to make good decisions. One of the things that really gives me a lot of hope in the future is what we call deliberative democracy. Essentially, you select people at random for a sortition or a lottery, which is what was done in ancient Athens, and you inform them with experts and let them make decisions. And over again, across different studies, and even in real-world examples like an Ireland during the abortion debate, we find that this tends to work pretty well. It results in less polarization. It tends to result in much better deliberation because people are more likely to change their mind than politicians are. And it tends to result in just better decisions as well. Most of the time right now.
Yeah, there is indeed a movement for that in Australia. It's a resolute movement, but it worries me, Luke. I don't see what the authority of those decisions is. I can't see that randomly selected people have the authority to impose on other people their decisions. But that's perhaps a discussion for another time. Look around the world for me as a last contribution to this conversation, Luke. Look around the world and tell me the society which the state you think is closest to societal collapse.
I'll push back a little bit on that because it's very easy for me to say one of the countries within the Horn of Africa, maybe, for instance, maybe Yemen, for instance, which is already more or less a state of civil war. But when we talk about societal collapse, we're usually talking about the collapse of an entire life. And the thing is that today we live in one global interconnected system. And when we do have collapse, such as the collapse of Somalia or Afghanistan, it tends to be very short-lived. Essentially, resources are mobilized to make sure that a new state is propped up very quickly. And when we talk about societal collapse, people are usually worried about a global collapse. And that is what we need to worry about. And if we're really thinking about a global collapse, then the things we have to start worrying about today are much more things like nuclear war, climatic change, and dangerous new technologies. And even all of those are once again built upon large systems of inequality and extraction. So I wouldn't worry about any given state. I'd worry about the world as a whole.
That is a way to cheer us up, Luke. We don't need to worry about the United States of America. Benjamin Franklin's worst fears may not be about to come true. The whole world could collapse. Luke, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live. Luke Kemp is, amongst many other things, the author of this book, Goliath's Curse, The History and Future of Societal Collapse. completely fascinating survey of catastrophe in the history of the world. It is to be published by Penguin Random House. Luke, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live. And that's the show. On our next, I have a terrific conversation with Alok Vaidmenon, trans poet and comedian, facing down hatred of their people here and in America with decency, humanity, and amazing good humour.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.